Welcome back to Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. I'm Emily.
And I'm Matt. We're kicking off season 7 with Emily's favorite movie. Have you ever wondered what would happen to the Earth if our electromagnetic field stopped functioning? Well, that's exactly the premise at the heart of today's episode.
We're talking The Core. It's got geology, planetary scientists, and electromagnetism, all with a complete disregard for any scientific accuracy. What's not to love?
Well, there are some little tidbits of plausibility hidden in this epic disaster film, and we'll take you through the good, the bad, and the should've catastrophically depressurized instantly. Today on Airspace, presented by Olay. This is Emily's favorite movie, according to Emily.
One of my favorite movies.
Yeah, and
let's give me a little credit.
And this is one of the few times where I have watched a movie for the first time that Emily knew about before I did. Like, usually Emily is the one who says, I don't know popular culture. I don't watch as many movies as you guys. But, you know, this is one time where Emily was ahead of the game. And so I watched it today. It's about 2 hours and 15 minutes long, which honestly felt like about a half hour longer than it should have been. But, you know, for a movie from 2003, it's a pretty ambitious science fiction film that centers on geology, which I'm assuming is why Emily loves this film. Is that right?
I mean, it's one of the reasons. I mean, there's some really epic scenes. The CGI is, you know, there. And the cast is surprisingly stacked. And the level to which they take disaster movie, natural disaster, solve it by setting off nuclear bombs is just so familiar, but they sort of take it to this whole other level. It's just so wild.
Yeah. There's definitely some callbacks to like the Armageddon type stuff that we've done episodes about Armageddon and how gloriously bad and inaccurate that movie is, but how much we love it. And I think this could be, you know, one of my new favorite movies to love to pick apart. And, you know, so thank you for bringing it to my attention. The other thing is it has like one of my favorite people in it, Stanley Tucci, and he manages to play a character that I absolutely hated through the entire movie. But before we go any further, we should probably summarize the film. So, Emily, because it's your favorite movie, why don't you go ahead and kick us off?
I don't know if I can summarize this quickly, but the movie starts off with a few sort of disaster-type scenes in a bunch of different places. We have people dropping dead. We have a very epic scene with the space shuttle being unable to land and a bunch of pigeons falling out of the sky, very Alfred Hitchcock, The Birds. And this is where we get introduced to the first few main characters, Josh and Serge, and then Dr. Zimsky. Zimsky is played by Stanley Tucci for all the fans, and they're the ones who come to the conclusion that the outer core has stopped spinning, the Earth's magnetic field has shut off, and the Earth will be over very soon.
What's the timeline here? As the EM field becomes more and more unstable, we'll start seeing isolated incidents. One plane will fall from the sky, and then two, and then in a few months, anything, everything electronic will be fried.
Static discharges in the atmosphere will create superstorms with hundreds of lightning strikes per square mile.
After that, it gets bad.
I would say that, you know, I did love that scene of the space shuttle having to land in the Los Angeles River.
That is confirmed. Turn right, heading 175. Expect visual contact with Los Angeles River in 5 seconds.
And in this case, you know, you have this great epic scene of the space shuttle having to land somewhere it was never intended to land. And there are all those bridges that go across the LA River, and it has to somehow negotiate all of that. I think that was probably one of my very favorite parts of the movie.
Well, hang on, this isn't going to be subtle.
Hands down, one of the best parts of the movie is trying to land the space shuttle. But that is a kind of the segue into really the second half of the movie, or the core of this film, if you will, which is that once they figure out that the magnetic field is deteriorating because the liquid outer core has stopped spinning, the rest of this movie is essentially, how do we solve the problem? Now, as any good disaster movie would have it, you solve the problem by setting off a bunch of nuclear warheads. That we should just take as an obvious conclusion of this film is that we blow things up. But essentially, the second half of the movie is about putting together the team of people, finding the ship that can tunnel into the Earth's core and how they set off the nuclear warheads in order to restart the core.
Dr. Brazelton will supervise the building of a ship which is capable of reaching the center of our planet. Once there, it will deliver an explosive charge large enough to restart its core.
It is pretty fantastic and implausible, right? But the movie does sort of recognize that kind of from the get-go, I feel. Like, it's like, introduces this scenario of, okay, the core has stopped spinning and we need to give it a jump start, but the only, the only jump start that will work is nuclear-powered jumper cables, right?
A tiny nudge in any direction will force the core back into its normal flow.
What's a tiny nudge in planetary terms?
About 1,000 megaton, give or take.
Tops, because any more than that would create a core instability.
But even if you could design nuclear-powered jumper cables, how do you actually get them to the core of the Earth? And so the movie starts with, like, we can't even get down there. We've never been that deep, which is true, right? Historically, there have been attempts to drill deep into the Earth, and they have not gotten that far. We've never even made it through the crust, let alone reached the core of the Earth.
Right. And so I kind of want to make a quick little pit stop, because I feel like we're going to keep using these same words over and over again, Matt. And so I want to do kind of a very oversimplified primer on the structure of the Earth as a planet.
Are you going to cut a peach in half and then use hairspray and a lighter to show me how, you know, we're going to be destroyed by all of that electromagnetic solar winds?
It's no longer stone fruit season. And I don't keep peaches in my closet. But the Earth is a little bit like a peanut M&M, where you have this crunchy outer layer, the candy coating, right? That's called the crust. That's what we live on. That's where the earthquakes happen. That's where a lot of the geology happens, right? It's in that hard, crunchy layer. Underneath, in the case of a peanut M&M, we're talking about the chocolate. In the Earth, we're talking about the mantle. It's kind of a mushy, gooey, much warmer, big section of the Earth's interior. And then you get to the core, or a peanut, right? Like in a peanut M&M. Now, this is where I'm going to actually pull away from the M&M analogy, because in this movie, it's really important to understand that the core comes in two pieces. You have the metal, hard inner core, and then on the outside of that core, you have a liquid metal layer. And that's what's spinning, and that's what's making the Earth's electric magnetic field. So think of it as a peanut M&M, but that peanut's kind of got two layers to it. And we're going to call that the inner core, which is the hard metal part, and the outer core, which is the liquid part. 69.
All right, we'll be through the crust in 15 minutes and into the mantle. 24 hours to the core, and then assuming we survive.
Assuming?
Yes, assuming. Another 15 hours to the inner core, outer core border.
Okay, so Emily, we've never been to the core. We've never seen it in person. The reason that we know that the core is structured the way it is because of seismology, right? We know how waves move through the Earth, and we've recorded them at different places around the Earth, and we've pieced together a sort of picture of what the interior of the Earth looks like. So that part I understand. One thing that I'm not fully sort of grasping is, you know, yes, the core creates this dynamo through the action of the liquid core around the solid inner core. But why does it do that? Why does the liquid core spin?
So the big reason this all happens is because that is a liquid, and it is a superheated liquid, right? Things at the center of planet tend to be really warm. Because as planets cool off, it gets cooler on the outside before it gets cooler on the inside. Because it's hot in there, you've got a lot of convection. The outer core is liquid, and as stuff rises towards the mantle boundary, the boundary between the outer core and the mantle, that's going to rise, it's going to cool off a little bit, then it's going to start to sink again. Then it gets hot again, and it does this cyclic cooling heating motion. That's called convection. And so it's that constant cycling of material that is one of the primary ingredients that goes into creating a magnetic field.
Right. And when you don't have that magnetic field that helps to protect your planet from solar radiation, solar winds, things that we talked about in our space weather episode last season, you know, you tend to get problems, right? So the film at least is right about that. If for some reason suddenly for no reason at all, the core stopped spinning and we lost the electromagnetic field, we would definitely be in dire straits.
Right. And, you know, it depends on how you shut it off. If you shut it off catastrophically, they'll feel a catastrophic effect. If you shut it off gradually, you're going to feel it more gradual effect. But that's, you know, that's a huge sci-fi gray area as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, past the beginning scenes in the movie, we start to get into the parts of the movie, the core, that I just find to be some of the most fun parts, including the discovery by a bunch of scientists and the team that they put together that there is, in fact, a ship that is some secret project that's been developed to create something that can tunnel into the center of the Earth. And this is where I think, Matt, you made a good point already. The movie doesn't necessarily take itself too seriously. You know, as soon as you find out that the ship is made out of unobtainium, message received.
So, Emily, you mentioned unobtainium, so maybe we should just talk about the ship, Virgil. You know, you have to build a ship and you have to put together a crew to actually pilot it. And that's where those astronauts from the beginning of the movie comes back, including the character played by Hilary Swank, Air Force pilot and astronaut named Beck, short for Rebecca, but she goes by Beck. You know, she ends up being one of the main heroic characters of the movie, piloting this ship. And how would you describe this ship? It's kind of like a big drill, right, with a very powerful sonic beam that comes out the front of it to tunnel through rock. It's like a cross between a train and a drill and a lightsaber.
Yeah, so the ship is designed to tunnel into the Earth, but drilling into the Earth is a really hard thing to do. And I think they probably took inspiration from the kinds of drills you see on oil rigs and other kinds of scientific equipment we use to get into the crust and to the interior of the Earth. Okay, we get into the crust. We never make it out of the crust. But the point being, right, like, it's just a giant version of what geologists are already using to get rock samples, drill wells, that kind of stuff.
With one exception, which is that it has these kind of sonic laser things at the front that just sort of blast through rock, and somehow miraculously there's no like residue left behind by the rock, so it creates a completely clean space that you can move through.
Right. I mean, we're suspending our disbelief here, but
yes,
you know,
we are suspending it very tightly.
I would like to know one of your favorite moments, Matt, as it's going through the different layers of the Earth. In the beginning of the episode, we broke down the interior of the Earth into kind of four main pieces. And so, much to my surprise, when I first saw this movie, which I think was in college, I was very surprised to find that one of the places where the ship stops is in what looks like one of the giant crystal caves in Mexico or something. It's this big void, like there's a geode in the middle of the Earth, sort of like those big things you see at like rock shops full of amethyst crystals.
That was one of my favorite scenes, and I'll tell you why. It was because, you know, when I started watching this movie, what I immediately thought about was, you know, the classic story of going to the center of the Earth, which is Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth. So when I saw this scene in this movie where they fall into this geode, which they weren't expecting, to me felt like a nod to Jules Verne and to the idea of a world within the world.
You know, I really like that point, Matt, because I never actually made the connection between this movie and Journey to the Center of the Earth, where there has to be way more parallels than I've acknowledged. But I do really appreciate that a movie like this is taking you to a place where you're like, oh, 100% that's not going to happen. There's no way that would happen in real life. And so this sort of mimics that feeling you sometimes get in science when you find something unexpected, and then you have to find out why it is the way it is. Without all the spoiler alerts, this would not be a natural disaster movie without multiple people that you've invested in dying, and then people making heroic sacrifices at the end of the movie. So while we're not going to tell you all the people who make it out, we do want to try and hit a couple other major plot points to kind of continue this message of how wonderful this movie is.
Of course.
And so one of the big plot points here that we sort of alluded to is, if it's a natural disaster movie, you're going to solve the problem by setting off a bunch of nuclear warheads. I mean, this is what we did in Armageddon. This is what we're going to do in the core, naturally. Now, the liquid outer core has stopped spinning. That's how the electromagnetic field got shut off. So the setting off of the nuclear warheads is another one of those, like, kind of, in my mind, very classic physics problems that they didn't not get wrong. which is essentially by creating a wave in the outer core's liquid. And waves, if you ever watch ripples on a pond, like you can either have two waves hit one another and get bigger, you can have two waves hit one another and disappear. So they rely on the physics of how waves work in order to try and strategically set off the bombs around the core to maximize the waves to kickstart it. Now, I don't know how you get from waves to kickstarting a core, but...
I'm not sure either.
The pictures made sense to me. They were very reminiscent of my physics books. And that's kind of the pinnacle of what sort of puts the cherry on top of this movie, is trying to strategically and very dramatically, because you can't set off a nuclear weapon without there being some heroic moment. And it's just such a great way of saving the world.
I came here to save my wife and my two children, and 6 billion lives, it's too much. I just hope I'm smart enough and brave enough to save three.
There's a lot more drama about getting to your goal than there is about how you get home. It shouldn't surprise you that they sort of glaze over some of the facts about how they manage to get out.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, they do get out, because it turns out that a property of unobtainium that they hadn't quite addressed before is that it basically can turn heat into power, and they're able to jerry-rig the ship so that now it can use the unobtainium as a power source. They are able to use the heat of the interior of the Earth to power them on their way up, which, as Emily pointed out, takes a lot less time than the way down, even though you'd imagine it might take the same amount or even longer to go up, but whatever.
I mean, Matt, was it worth it?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just glad we finally got to do it, because it's, I don't know, it's up there. It's solid. It is solidly entertaining. And who doesn't want that in life?
It was that. It was just, you know, there were some scenes that dragged on a little bit, and it did kind of push your ability to suspend disbelief at moments. If you know any of the science, it can be a little bit of a bumpy ride to the center of the Earth.
Airspace is from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. It's produced by Katie Moyer and Jennifer Weingart, mixed by Tarek Fuda. Additional help from Amy Stamm and Sophia Soto-Sugar. Did you know that Airspace has a monthly newsletter? You can sign up through the link in the show notes and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at AirspacePod. Airspace is presented by Olay and distributed by PRX.